thank Professor Jean Mullet for accepting to deliver this lecture today. So please welcome Professor John.
Thank you very much. Oh, I wish my students did that every week. Listen, welcome to Paris Sorbonne. I hope you're enjoying your visit to Paris and you don't spend all your money in the shops. First of all, I have to thank Dr. Aboubakar and Dr. Fouache for inviting me to give this lecture here in this magnificent lecture theatre in the University of the Sorbonne. And when you look at this lecture theatre, I think you think two things. Firstly, you think, wow, what an intellectual history, you know, did Descartes sit there, you know, did Voltaire sit there, I don't know. But secondly, I think you might think, was this just for the elite? Was this not for everybody? And so it's very interesting that exactly 50 years ago, in this room, people were debating how to have a different university, and their slogan was, down with the bourgeois university, long live the university of the people. So, why did that happen, and how did it happen? Just checking the microphone here. That's what I'm going to look at. My name, then, is John Mullen. I'm professor at the University of Rouen. Is the microphone okay? Do you hear clearly? Good. I'm professor at the University of Rouen, about an hour north of here on a train. I usually lecture on British history of the 20th and 19th century, but today I'm going to talk for 40 minutes about 1968 in France, and then there will be plenty of time for questions, so please prepare questions. My aim is to give you a general overview of the 1968 crisis, but also show you a little of what historians try to do with it, a little bit what is the job of historians, which may not be exactly what you think. So, here's the structure of my talk. Firstly, I'm going to look at the questions. Why is everybody talking about May 1968? Then I will go through the highlights in a few minutes. After that, I'm going to move on to the context. What was post-war France like? What kind of society produced this explosion? And then the international context. What was going on elsewhere in 1968? So you will need to look deep into your minds to see if you can remember some history of that period, perhaps. After that, I'll go on to the actual events of the crisis before going on to my favourite bit, what questions are historians asking? Because, and this is the message of today, three-quarters of a historian's job is finding good questions. The answers is easy afterwards. Okay, so first of all, everybody is talking about it. A huge number of publications, broadcasts and events have greeted the 50th anniversary of the 1968 events. And here you have three magazines, Historia, 68, L'année qui a tout changé, the year which changed everything. Yeah, it's quite impressive. The same one in L'Express, a more conservative newspaper, 1968 to 2018, how everything changed. And finally, L'Histoire, May 68, Le Monde tremble, the world was trembling. Okay, so obviously a very melodramatic approach to the event, which is interesting. In fact, there have been more events to commemorate 1968 than to commemorate the 75 years of the Second World War. But the Second World War caused probably 40 million deaths. And four people died in the events of 1968. So that's my first question, is why is everybody talking about it so much? Here we have a few more examples. On the left, you see the official National Archives. That's the official government archives organising then a special exhibition this year about that. In the centre, you see a theatre play about 1968. And then on the right, it's another theatrical production. So the theatres are interested in 1968. And just in the town where I live, outside Paris, here are two examples. This is on the left is my local bookshop. They have loads of books about 1968. And on the right, posters, the Communist Party having a meeting, how to understand 1968. So there was my first question there, is why is everybody talking about it? I will come back to this. all these books and all these debates, and I have 40 minutes. I could do 4 hours, no problem, but I have 40 minutes. So I'm going to begin with what I think were the highlights, what makes it a very special time, what was unusual about it. And these were, there you get a whole load of the books which have been published this year, just some of the books which have been published this year. Okay, so the highlights, what are the things which make 1968 in France so remarkable? I found six. First of all, then, barricades on the streets of Paris, riots and mass pitch battles between police and young people, hundreds of wounded, as I said, very few people were killed, but hundreds of wounded, and on the outskirts of Paris at the end of May, the tanks were ready. The tanks never moved, but the tanks were ready. So that's the first impressive thing, a very, very high level of social struggle. Secondly, these are my highlights, imaginative slogans which covered the walls of the city. These are the things which people remember about 1968, these slogans. Il est interdit d'interdire. Forbidding is forbidden. It is forbidden to forbid. So, poetic, imaginative slogans. Just next to that, you have sous les pavés la plage. Yeah. It is under the cobblestones in the streets that you will find the beach. And the idea is, of course, if you pick up the cobblestones to throw them at the police, you will get to the beach, a better life with more joy, etc. This is there. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's what was said. On the bottom left, then, you have Soyez réaliste, demandez l'impossible. These are all from photos from 1968, yeah? Be realistic, ask for the impossible. Okay, obviously, it gives an idea, I think, of the atmosphere of possibility which was alive in 1968. And on the bottom right, perhaps more in connection with the workers than the students, down with the hellish work rates. This is the area of factories, very small motions, very repetitive, very fast, and that was one of the ideas. And indeed, one of the remarkable things about 1968 is how, for a short time, workers and students found themselves together. So that was my second highlight, the slogans. Third highlight, 9 million workers on strike for a few weeks, often occupying their factories, offices and schools. At the time, this was the biggest general strike in history. It's not today. There have been bigger ones in India. There were four times as many strikers as in the great strikes of 1936, which everybody remembers. So something very, very impressive and unusual. My fourth highlight deals with the question of President de Gaulle. Because for one day, only one day, in the middle of the 1968 crisis, he disappeared. He left the country and he didn't tell the Prime Minister where he was going. And this is not something that presidents usually do. You know, this is like, you know, normally in the job, you do not disappear is in the contract, usually. And so something extremely unusual from a historian's point of view. My fifth highlight is that the radical and revolutionary groups found themselves with much more influence than they ever had imagined possible for a few months. So you had groups who usually held a meeting in a cafe with 20 or 30 people and they were happy. And then at the end of May 1968, they had a meeting in a football stadium. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that everybody in the football stadium agreed with them, but usually they organised meetings in cafes and suddenly they were in a football stadium. And this is something I think historians are very interested in. There you have three examples of the radical and revolutionary left groups in the centre, people who were looking to China as a model. On the left, people who were following the ideas of Leon Trotsky and other things that were around at the time. And my final highlight, my final surprising thing about 1968, number six, is that at the end of June 1968, there were general elections and President de Gaulle's parties won easily. So again, from a historian's point of view, we need to ask all of the interesting questions in history begin with why. So the point is, why did De Gaulle win? When you see this incredible result, and then De Gaulle won the elections. Okay, so those are my highlights. Now, context. What kind of society produced such an explosion? Well, we need to go back to the end of the war. I'm sure you remember this is, I'm talking about the Second World War, ending in 1945. France, at the end of the war, had suffered tremendously. First of all, the population was divided. The country was occupied by Germany and led by a French collaborationist government, collaborating with Hitler. And so at the end of the war, there was a whole load of restructuring that was needed. But even physically, at the end of the war, many French towns had suffered terrible bombing at the beginning of the war by the Germans and then later by the Americans and British. And here you have a couple of towns. I think probably the best example is Caen. And if you go to Caen, you see the main avenue. And the position of the main avenue was decided by an American general, because the town was so destroyed, they couldn't find the streets. And so the American general said, the main road is there. So they just give you an idea how much destruction there was. Now, the following 20 or 30 years are known in English, in French, as les Trente Glorieuses, the 30 glorious years. It always sounds a little bit amusing as a label, but I think it, in many ways it is justified. It may be a strong word, but ordinary people's lives got much better. Even poor people were wearing shoes. Ordinary working people could afford to see a doctor when they were ill. Yeah, before the war, you called a doctor if your children were ill, but adults, you didn't use the money for a doctor. The newly established Sécurité Sociale made sure that everybody could get a doctor, and as you can see on the slide, people could, little by little, have washing machines and televisions. Now, of course, washing machines are an unimportant detail unless you don't have one, because it's a tremendous amount of work. Washing was more work at the time, because the modern detergent is much better. And so 1930s women doing the washing were working much harder than we are doing the washing. So we have a situation of prosperity. Here you have an advert for a kitchen machine which will liberate women. Yeah, you don't have to do so much cooking because you have a kitchen machine. Of course, it's advertising, but people's lives were changing. And here you have the image then of the 30 glorious years with the 2.4 children and the car and the television and the aeroplane. Of course, at this time, not everybody went on an aeroplane. That's our general image of the period, and it's quite accurate. Things really did get a lot better. People had toilets inside their houses and not outside their houses. These are important changes. Nevertheless, there was still poverty. In France, in 1968, there were still 5 million people below the poverty line. Unemployment was low compared to today, but there were almost 500,000 without a job. And the work in the new factories, which were springing up everywhere, car factories, steel mills, chemical and plastics factories, was hard work and repetitive work. On average, ordinary people worked 46 or 48 hours a week. More and more women went out to work, which allowed them more control over their lives, but also exposed them to long working hours. And of course, as you can imagine, they were not paid as much as the men. Housing was getting better, but there were still people living in slums. This is 1968, of course. This is not the majority of the population, but the poor population was still living in... this is actually Nanterre, just outside Paris, in 1968. On the international scene, the French experience was dominated by the experience of the Algerian War. 1954 to 1962, the Algerian War. 1 million people died, most of them Algerian, before Algerian independence was won. And here you have two posters, a poster supporting the war for French Algeria, a poster against the war, and this is a part of the horrors of the Algerian War, which I won't describe in detail because it's depressing. Okay, so that's the French context. The other part of the French context is the students. The number of the new chemical factories, plastics factories, washing machine factories, they needed engineers, they needed technicians, they needed lawyers, they needed accountants. So the number of students rose very, very quickly. Although there were far fewer than there are today, in 1968, 12% of young people go to university. Today, there are 2.5 million students in France, and in 1968, there were 700,000. But 700,000 was the biggest group ever. And these students, their lives were going to be different from those of their parents. And in the international context that we'll see in a moment, there developed feelings of revolt, which exploded in 1968. Finally, politically, although in 1944 the dictatorship had been replaced with a democracy, there were many aspects of the regime under President de Gaulle, here he is, which were causing discontent. The political parties supporting de Gaulle had won only a narrow victory in 1967, and de Gaulle's regime was seen as rigid. The radio and television was a state monopoly. Every night, the contents of the television news went first to the minister before it went on the television. If we move on to the international context, this is a context of tremendous dissent, tremendous revolts. The terrible American war in Vietnam continued to rage, but in 1968, the situation appeared to be changing. With a new offensive, the North Vietnamese put the US Army in great difficulty. For the first time, it seemed to millions of people that America might lose. Now, I think we've forgotten today how incredibly surprising and shocking was the idea that the United States, the biggest power in the history of the world, lost the war to a small, poor country of Vietnam. And this, to millions of people around the world, everything seemed possible suddenly. And the very, very big movement against the Vietnam War was much encouraged. But only a month before May 1968 in the United States, there was another tremendous event which catalyzed the feelings of revolt. Martin Luther King was assassinated. All across the United States, riots broke out in protest. Finally, in March 1968 in Poland, there had been a revolt in Eastern Europe, important strikers against the government, and demonstrators chanting, "Down with the red bourgeoisie," so treating the Communist Party leadership in the East the same as the elite in the West fundamentally. That's enough context. Let's look at some events. I'm going to do the events in just a few minutes and then get on to the questions. The events, there you go. This is my favourite typeface character. Where do we start? 22nd of March. So this, obviously, this is before. 22nd of March, there is an occupation. About 100 students occupy the administrative buildings in connection with the movement against the Vietnam War. And here you see an example of a student meeting. It looks nice. It doesn't look like it's going to move 10 million people into action. Not really, yeah. So a fairly ordinary event, but this was the foundation of the organisation, the movement of the 22nd of March, which was going to be very important. The University of Nanterre, which is just outside Paris, was closed. On the 2nd of May, there was an attack by the extreme right on a student union building, and as a result of fighting between student union activists and the fascists, the Dean of Nanterre closed down the campus. The Nanterre students went over to the... The Nanterre students moved over to the Sorbonne here. The head of the Sorbonne asked the police to come and get rid of them, and that is when the fighting began between the students and police. More than 100 people were injured, and the Sorbonne was closed. Again, so far we're really looking at a fairly typical student movement: 500 students, 1,000 police, you know, something which might not be very pleasant, but which is not looking historic in any way. But by the 6th of May, further student demonstrations in the Latin Quarter, barricades, 600 students injured, 345 police officers injured, 422 people arrested, and the protest movement starts to spread to the provinces. I will come back to this question, one of the important questions: why did the students fight so hard against the police? It was not typical. And I suspect, to go ahead of myself a little bit, that one of the answers is in the international context, in the fact that the radical students were feeling that now is the time. Yeah, there's riots in America, there's a revolt elsewhere, now is the time. Although there were many people seriously injured, the police were being careful not to repeat the situation of 6 years earlier when 9 demonstrators were shot dead on a demonstration against the Algerian war. Now, most of the arrested on these demonstrations were students, but historians have recently gone into the detailed archives of the police, and they find that, in fact, there were also a lot of young workers, apprentices, cafe waiters, secretaries, and others. At this time, the demonstrators of the movement were getting their information from the radio, the transistor radio, which existed now, not from the French radio stations, but from stations abroad, Radio Luxembourg in particular, which would give information which the government-controlled radio would not. But the big change probably comes on the 10th of May. The 10th of May, I think the newspaper is actually from 2 days earlier. I got a little confused. What changed is that the protest movement began to spread outside Paris, but also the general public began to support the students. I will come back to this question. Why would they do that? And by the 13th of May, the trade union leaders had decided to call a one-day general strike in support of the students. Approximately 800,000 people demonstrated in Paris. In all the big cities across France, there are similar demonstrations: Nantes, Lyon, Clermont-Ferrand, Marseille, and Grenoble. Now, a one-day general strike was not so unusual. The trade unions had had 3 or 4 in the previous years, and usually you had a one-day general strike and then it was back to business as usual. And this was probably the intention of the trade union leadership. But at the, on the 14th of May in the morning, in many factories and workplaces around the country, it said, no, we're not going back to work, we're staying on strike. And this was the beginning of a general strike which lasted 3 weeks. 3 weeks is very long for a general strike. Yeah? The trains didn't run, the metro didn't run. The hospitals could receive supplies in some regions only if they had the permission of the trade union. Very, very, very unusual situation. The government did not seem to understand how serious the situation was. And so on the 14th of May, President Charles de Gaulle went to Romania on an official trip for 5 days. He obviously wasn't worried. And that, I think, is something that has changed. Political leaders today have learnt the lesson. As soon as there is a crisis, they don't leave the country. France became unrecognisable. Across the country, hundreds of workplaces were occupied. In many workplaces, they kidnapped the bosses and kept them locked in their offices, even though the leadership of the trade unions were opposed to this tactic. This was no ordinary strike. The trade union leaders were overtaken by the movement. The leader of the biggest union, the CGT, declared that an unlimited general strike was not necessary, but nobody was listening. And each group of workers began to add their own demands to the idea of defending the students. In the Paris metro, for example, they were asking for 40 hours a week only, and every week 2 consecutive days off. That's just an example. There were 100 things going on around the place. The strike began in the private sector, especially in the huge car factories. Some of the car factories around Paris had 10,000 workers in one factory. But gradually it moved on to the public services, and by the 22nd of May, more than 9 million people were on strike. The factories were occupied, and debates were held on all political subjects. In some regions, the workers controlled the government. In at least one region in the north, the head of the police had to ask permission of the trade unions to buy petrol for the police vehicles. And there we have the an example of the 22nd of May. That's one of the car factories. You can see that quite a lot of people working there. At this point, one of the leaders of the student movement, the most famous one, Daniel Cohn-Bendit, was not allowed back into France after he had visited Germany. And this was interesting because the authorities tended to think that there was some kind of conspiracy going on. A section of the establishment was convinced that China was organizing this revolt. Now this is a very interesting point of view of the mentality of some kinds of power. In reality, if you want to organize 9 million people to go on strike in another country, it's extremely difficult. And even if China had wanted to, you know, it just doesn't work like that. But in fact, certainly I think a section of the establishment were frankly paranoid. Recent research shows that the French Secret Service set up a special investigation of the general manager of the huge car company Renault. This is the general manager with 20,000 workers. And they thought, maybe he's a communist. Let's check. He wasn't a communist. He was a general manager of 20,000 workers. But that's the kind of... they didn't necessarily have a clear view of what was going on. So, as May went on, there was no real sign of change. And on the 24th of May, General de Gaulle made a television broadcast proposing a referendum. Now, a referendum is very different from an election, of course. A referendum is, are you with me or are you against me? And this was General de Gaulle's idea of the best way forward. But in fact, nobody followed this idea of a referendum. People in his own party said, no, you haven't understood, this is not going to work. In the demonstrations, the slogan changed and they began to sing, adieu de Gaulle, adieu de Gaulle, adieu de Gaulle, adieu. But as we will see, he had other ideas. On the 25th of May, negotiations began between the government and the trade unions. And you can see they look fairly serene. Nevertheless, Jacques Chirac, who was later president of France, was at this meeting and he had a gun. He explains later in his autobiography, he had a gun because he was terrified something terrible was going to happen. Yeah. And in fact, you can see what happened. Negotiations went on. They negotiated for 2 days, and the result was an increase of 30% of the minimum wage, an increase of all other wages by 10%, the establishment of an official right to a trade union branch in every company, even if the manager does not like the idea, and finally, the abolition of the right of employers to hire younger workers at wages below the minimum wage. So this is really extremely impressive. You know, if you want a 30% wage rise, usually it's just almost impossible to get. At this time, inflation was 4%. And so I think it's fair to say that the elite were terrified. They said, oh, here's 30%. You know, I think they were pretty terrified. Nevertheless, surprisingly enough, this is not the end of the strike. The trade union leaders, who are professional negotiators, the most important thing to remember, the trade union leaders are professional negotiators, and they have all the advantages and all the faults of professional negotiators. They were delighted with the results. But many strikers were not. The strikes would continue for weeks. In many factories and workplaces, they managed to gain something more. You remember, this is the national negotiation, which gives something to everybody. But afterwards, in this factory, they gained, the 45-hour week. And in different places, they managed to win other things. Interestingly enough, the negotiations won nothing specifically for the students. What really frightened the government was the workers not working. And nobody liked student movements. Well, sorry, nobody in the establishment likes student movements. So there you go. The following day, on the 27th of May, the radical left held a meeting in a sports stadium at Charlotte. And this is the meeting I was mentioning. These are groups who normally have meetings in cafes, and suddenly they found themselves in a football stadium. And here you have two of the posters of unity, talking of unity between workers and students. This one then, factories, universities, union. And this one is about racism, French workers, immigrant workers united. On the 29th of May, the 29th of May is the day when de Gaulle disappears. General de Gaulle suddenly disappears without even informing the Prime Minister. He takes a lot of luggage, his wife, his family, the family jewels, and he goes to a French military base in Germany. He contacts the French ambassador in Germany to ask if it might be possible for him to stay in Germany. So you see, he's beginning the negotiation. This is information we historians have found recently, because the archives have been opened. But the military general at the base in Germany persuades de Gaulle that it is his duty to go back to France and face the situation. So what's interesting here is that faced with a generalized crisis, de Gaulle, although he has been a politician for many years and in a political party for many years, when there's a real crisis, he wants to talk to his military comrades. That's what he's a military man fundamentally. The following day then, his prime minister is extremely angry. When the president disappears, the prime minister is absolutely furious. This is George Pompidou, you know. This is not part of the game. You know, it's like, oh, I'm not there, you know. However, the following day, de Gaulle comes back and has a conversation with his prime minister. De Gaulle says, I want a referendum. Pompidou says, if you call a referendum, I will resign. And the compromise is that the General de Gaulle makes a radio broadcast. Very interesting, not a television broadcast. His advisors are thinking that he doesn't look good. But a radio broadcast where he says, we will have new elections. Not a referendum, new elections. From the point of view of Gaullism, a very good idea. Because not only does de Gaulle's party has won the election, but the most intelligent people knew they would win. And that evening, hundreds of thousands of de Gaulle's supporters march in Paris. This demonstration had been prepared for several days and is accompanied by other demonstrations the same day and the following day in support of de Gaulle. Committees for the Defence of the Republic are organised to oppose the strike and support de Gaulle. A few of them have military people in them who are preparing in case there is a civil war. This is one of the big questions. Why was there no civil war? It was not impossible at the time. I will come back to that. 31st of May, the Prime Minister announces a government reshuffle, new ministers. The Communist Party leadership, the Communist Party at this time is very powerful, 20% of the votes, approximately. And the Communist Party leadership agree that elections are the best way forward, and from now on they will try to stop the strikes. And in fact, the Communist Party leadership will be much more effective in stopping the strikes because they have the trust of the people. Over June, slowly, with the election campaign beginning, the strikers go back to work one by one. Well, not one by one, one factory at a time. Nevertheless, the return to work is slow and contested. On the 6th of June, there are still 2 million people on strike. In clashes with police, three people are killed in June. On the 12th of June, the left-wing groups, the radical groups whose newspapers you saw earlier, are banned by the government, and one of their leaders, Alain Krivine, is imprisoned for 6 months. The elections on the 23rd and 30th of June are won easily by the Gaullists. Not so much by the number of votes. In the first round, the right-wing parties have 10.5 million votes. The left-wing parties have 9 million votes. In the second round, the right-wing parties have 7 million votes and the left-wing parties 6 million votes. But there are two reasons that the Gaullists win the elections easily. Number one, everybody under 21 cannot vote. And most of the movement were the young people. Yeah. This will change later on. Today it's 18, but at the time it's 21. So that's obviously a big advantage to de Gaulle. And secondly, the left wing was divided. The Communist Party and the alliance, which will become again the Socialist Party, you know, two blocks who were not together, whereas on the right they united around de Gaulle. And because of the electoral system, I will not give you the details, but you know that in some electoral systems it's a great advantage to have one united party. That was the case, and so the new parliament was very much Gaullist. Nevertheless, de Gaulle will have been weakened by this situation, and in the following year, in April 1969, he will resign. Which brings me on to, I'm close to the conclusion now, but this brings me on to my favourite part, which is questions historians are asking. And I just repeat what I was saying earlier, that in my opinion, the job of a historian is to find good questions, which is not as easy as it sounds, actually, finding good questions. Sometimes you can. Some great history books have been written because somebody found a better question. I couldn't talk about that later. So here are my favourite questions. I'm not going to give you answers to all of them. I don't have answers to all of them. Why did nobody see it coming? Nobody saw it coming. The right-wing commentators didn't see it coming. The left-wing commentators didn't see it coming. The government didn't see it coming. Now that's very interesting because, you know, a lot of people are paid quite well to analyse society and politics and find out what's going to happen. But they weren't very good this time. I'll leave that one with you. Why are people so interested 50 years later? I have some elements of answers here. People are tremendously interested, hundreds of books. I think the reason is that there remains an element of mystery. Yeah, nobody saw it coming, and so today people say, well, why did this happen? How could it happen? So it remains a mystery, and also people do not agree. There are many different historians, good historians, who have completely different views about why it happened and how it was possible. And of course, people like a good fight. It is the source of a huge disagreement. Those people who believe that radical change is possible look at 1968 as a great example of mass revolt which could have gone much further. Those people who think that the present economic system is quite good or fits human nature want to explain why they think that 1968 did not represent another possibility, that it was exceptional and bound to end in failure. People have different tactics about this. It's very interesting that 10 years ago, the conservative presidential candidate Nicolas Sarkozy said that to rebuild French values, we need to destroy the inheritance of 1968. However, the present conservative president, Emmanuel Macron, prefers to think that 1968 is in the same tradition as his ideas of neoliberalism. So you have the facts of history, and then everybody can do with them not exactly what they want, but a lot of different things. Why did millions of workers go on strike initially to support students? The students were rather elite. You know, though 12% of the young population went to university, it was not the poorest 12%. It was the more the privileged. And nevertheless, the workers supported them. I don't have an answer on this one. I'm leaving this one with you. When the strike won massive wage rises, why were so many workers disappointed to see it end? Well, although the Grenelle plan made huge reforms, 30% more on the minimum wage, 10% more on other wages, etc., people had really, in 3 weeks of occupying their factories and their workplaces, discussing what kind of world was possible, they had extremely high expectations. And they didn't want to go back to working in the factory, even for more money. I'm not talking about everybody, but a large number, and more than was expected. Why did de Gaulle panic? That's a fascinating one. Heads of state usually do not panic. In fact, if you want to be a head of state, it's better not to be a panicky sort of person. I'm just telling you this in case you need to know. Certainly, if you look at the revolutions in Eastern Europe 30 years ago, some of the leaders who were defeated and were executed, they didn't panic, even when they were being executed, you know. So there's something very, very interesting about de Gaulle. And de Gaulle has a very interesting history. He was just a military man, and he had the right idea at the right time and became the head of state of France when in normal situations he wouldn't have done. Why was there not a civil war? This is a fascinating question. Many of the politicians of the 60s had been active in the resistance during the war. So they knew what war was, they knew what street fighting was, that didn't terrify them. The resistance was very, very hard. Yeah, people lost a lot of people there. And the civil war was possible. Occasionally, state representatives were tempted with military action. The police chief in Nantes, there was a student demonstration which occupied the police central headquarters in Nantes, and the students burned the car of the head of police. And the head of police telephoned Paris and said, "Can I shoot them?" Yeah? And the Minister of the Interior said, "No, you can't." But nevertheless, you know, it was close. In general, it's fair to say that de Gaulle considered it was possible, perhaps, to use military action. However, Pompidou was absolutely opposed to military action. Final question. Why do 79% of French people have a positive view of 1968? I think that's wonderful. There is almost nothing that 79% of French people agree on. Really, we as French, we love to disagree. So that's an interesting. Again, I'm not giving you answers. I'm giving you questions, not answers. Okay, so I've almost finished. What is the legacy? Well, of course, if you look at what happened to the leaders of 1968, well, really, if you have a 9 million people on strike and hundreds of workplaces occupied, you have thousands of local leaders. And mostly they continued their life more or less as normal afterwards. The famous ones are not typical. And among the famous ones you have everything. On the left here you have Alain Krivine, who was imprisoned in 1968. And here he is, much older, still giving out leaflets, yeah? And on the right you have Daniel Cohn-Bendit, who was an anarchist leader in 1968. And the most famous... and today he is a supporter of the conservative president, Emmanuel Macron. Now, it's true that if you ask Emmanuel Macron, is he a conservative, he says no. But I think he is the only person who believes this. So there you go. There you have your opinions about 1968 on a different opinion poll. Positive impact 70%, negative impact 15%. And very last slide, like this year in the student movement, the students like to paint this slogan, May 1968, they are commemorating it, we are starting again. Thank you very much.